All right, this is Eric Elifson again, Senior Fellow for the Center for the Advancement of Christian Education. I'm here with my buddy and new friend, who I got to meet this summer and have gotten to know and really enjoy tons of conversations with, but I probably could spend all day, Rex Miller. Rex Miller of Mindshift, who is an author of 4 books and working on his 5th book called The Healthy Workplace Nudge. He's a consultant for major corporations, for nonprofits, for educational institutions. And I found really interesting, Rex, that you're a coach. Coach for athletes in the, you know, tennis player, golfer, pole vaulter. So you kind of do it all and have been all over the place doing some really cool things. So in the 3 questions, my first question for you is, what is a mind shift and why are they so hard and why are they necessary?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you've ever tried to diet, then you know how hard it is to change. It really takes a shift in your thinking about yourself and your goals and all the networks that you've created. You've got to think differently about the food you eat, the people you hang out with. So what I found in the corporate world is that we pretty much know what to do. It's not the know what that's the problem. We know how to equip people. We know all about motivation. We know all about engagement. And the challenge is the thinking that we've kept, we don't give up to try to get to a new place. And so what we found is when people go through a basic fundamental shift in thinking, paradigm change, for lack of a better word, then they're open to thinking about the problem in a whole new way. You know, some of this came out of my work at TAG Consulting. I was a senior partner there for 3 years. And it's run by clinical psychologists, family systems psychologists. Out of that, what we found is that leaders are typically good at solving 2 kinds of problems: the tactical problems that require expertise, know-how, great execution, controls, and then strategic problems. Where do we need to go? How do we set a new course? How do we get alignment? But then there's a third problem that probably none of us got any training, and that's adaptive or transformational. When you hit something that you don't have any prior history of, a good friend of mine, Todd Bolsinger, wrote a book called Canoeing the Mountains. It's a great church leadership book about Lewis and Clark coming to the end of the Missouri River, thinking they were going to float down to the Pacific and then running into the Rocky Mountains. So what do you do when your mental map, all the equipment and gear and training you have no longer equips you for the next road ahead? Then you've got to lead by learning. And it's a totally different kind of leadership style. The key there is not setting a vision. The key is not being an expert, because you don't know what, I mean, you can't see beyond the mountains and you've never climbed a mountain before. Now it's, what are the key questions we need to be asking ourselves? How do we reframe the question? So in the early example I was sharing with you about the construction world, the whole idea was, how do we take conflict out of the process? But there was a more fundamental question. The system is designed to create conflict. So now what do you do? Yeah. If the system is designed to do that, everything you're trying to do, you know, the team building and all that stuff, won't take, because it's within a system of distrust and conflict. So now you have to ask, well, what would a system of trust look like? And then who is doing it? So it was we had to get to the point where we were at the end of the questions that made any sense anymore. How do you create trust in a system that's basically creates distrust? Didn't work. And all the techniques and all the know-how and all the things we know about that didn't work. But when we asked the question, what would a trust-based system look like? That opened up all kinds of new possibilities. And that was the mind shift.
So that goes with a little bit with question two, in the sense of in your book, The Millennial Matrix, you talk about, leaders having the tiger by the tail, or yeah. being on the treadmill and yeah. Consistently going off of it. Why do you think, in a sense of building this trust or building these sorts of organizations or systems, why won't the leaders let go of that, tiger in some ways? Why won't they get off the treadmill? And why won't they, go through, this mind shift process of creating possibly something much greater and better?
Yeah, because their identity is tied to the thing that made them successful to begin with. So if you look at the training they've had, they were trained to be pulpit leaders, right? For the most part, pastors. Principals were trained to kind of be the captain of their ships, so to speak. The leader with the answers and the solutions. And so there is no safety net. They don't know how to move in the other way. And it's only a place of learning by doing. I'm going to use a hospital example, because I was just in a major academic research hospital a couple weeks ago. And they're trying to move 3,000 people to over a 5-year master plan. And one of the big changes is that they need to move doctors out of private offices because they've run out of space and they've run out of budget, and the patient demands are increasing. So in order to have money to take care of patients, they've got to do these two things. The doctors are having a major revolt. And so one of the doctors I was meeting with, and I met with 19 of them, they all basically said, I can't do research without a private office. If you're an adaptive leader looking at it through a transformational lens, what you hear is, I don't know how to do research. And so now the question is, how do we reframe the challenge? And the challenge isn't, you need less space and we're going to kick you out of your private office. The question is, what does research look like in the future where costs are limited and patient demands are increasing? If that's the mission, we've got these constraints and this is our mission, what does the future of research look like and how do we adapt to that? And here's the parameters we have to work with. So how do you take somebody and ease them into looking at the problem from the deeper level? It's not about losing office space. It's really about, we've got constrained conditions that are put upon us that we can't change. California, water restrictions. How do you divide up the water? Everyone's used to the water. So now it's, what does the new normal look like and how do we migrate there? And how do we ease the pain to get there?
So in this, maybe a follow-up question, that how often do you see that leaders are able to make this adjustment or make this shift in thinking in this process?
Seldom, if almost never.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Seldom. Yeah, because of their concern and insecurity. I mean, we ran into some of that out in California where people are afraid of their boards. So that if you're in a fear-based environment to begin with, you can't afford to experiment, take risks. So somehow you have to build that capacity in by creating stakeholders in the new journey. So you have to bring the board members into the challenges of the competing tensions that your organization faces. You have to do discovery. You have to go find people who are further down the road. William Gibson has a great quote. He's a science fiction writer. Future's already here. It's not evenly distributed. So let's go find people who have crossed the same threshold, so we're not reinventing the wheel, so we don't feel like we're on a tightrope with no net behind us. Let's go look and see instead of trying to just wing it.
So then that goes with the third question, because it was part of, a follow-up from the innovation retreat this summer and follow-up email conversation. We're in it, and in your work in education, you found that, as you did design thinking and as you kind of reversed your way back through this process of looking at the educational system, that you found that at the roots of the educational system were a lot of fear and insecurity. Tell us more how you got to that place, discovery, and maybe even some suggestions about how do you overcome a system that's based on these two issues or these two, dramatically destructive things.
So any performance-based environment can go into a fear-based environment, because if your security is based on your performance, even in a marriage or with kids, and what we found is that testing, at least in public schools especially, was a major driver. And in Texas, it's teach to the test. They no longer teach for learning. It's you've got to produce these test outcomes or your revenue is affected and your career as a principal or a teacher is affected. And as soon as that becomes the criteria of success, it just leads to focusing on preventing that negative outcome from happening. And so it goes all the way through the organization to the kids. I mean, look at how stressed out kids get about the tests they have to take. You and I never experienced that growing up. I never went to an ACT prep. I didn't even know that existed. But now there's huge money in that just to make sure you get that college score. We've seen it in sports, kids sports now. It's no longer playing for fun. You've got to be in a traveling team or just don't even bother playing sports. So the stakes have gotten so high. And part of that is the parents have these high expectations. When we were going to school, a teacher typically had equal or better education than 70% of the parents they worked with. But now, at least in the suburban schools, these parents are master's degrees, doctors, or whatever, so they think they're equally qualified to educate. So the pressures are everywhere, the resources are thinner, and that leads to survival thinking, and that leads to 70% of teachers are disengaged. And I think mainly in this new research on health and well-being in the workplace, I'm starting to see the correlation between stress and disengagement. Because we saw that in learning, we saw that stress in at-risk communities. Cortisol, the adrenal gland, the amygdala is on high alert. Learning is a cognitive load. And when you have all that going on, if you come from a turbulent home or a chaotic home, and you're already stressed, and then you have to do a math problem, boom, you've got no capacity, and then you act out. And so the at-risk schools are learning, how do we manage that stress? So I think my new aha since the education book is we're dealing with stress overload. And then that leads to fear, and that leads to all the acting out and the games and the politics and everything just to survive.
So maybe to kind of conclude and to finish up is, with the new book, is there any kind of preview you can give us on maybe some of what you're learning about, about some of those healthy workplaces where, people are engaged, they're thriving, where stress is managed, and it's a trust-based organization?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, it's cultural. It's not a program. So wellness programs don't work. They just flat don't work. But culture, a healthy culture, works. We find that the healthiest companies are not self-conscious about wellness programs. They're just healthy cultures. Psychological safety was Google's research on what makes a high-performing team. The number one criteria is psychological safety. You can bring yourself to work, good, bad, and indifferent. We found that it starts with leadership, setting the tone, walking the talk. Congruence is key. If you don't have congruence, then it's not going to happen. And then the healthy side of it, too, is helping look at what your particular community needs to feel connected with one another, to feel resourced, to push decision-making down to the people who are having to do the work. Top-down doesn't work in complex systems and organizations. So that's some of the preview. And the big thing we saw is that with all the focus on wellness, well-being really starts first. It comes before wellness. 70% of all primary care visits are because of stress for depression. And 85% of our medical costs are because of five lifestyles, coping mechanisms to stress. So I think stress is the underlying story.
Well, Rex, you know, thanks so much for this and for this opportunity to record this and to share this with the broader audience. And I look forward to connecting with you in the future and doing some more of this work together, hopefully.
Yeah, likewise.
Thanks, Rex.
Yeah, take care.